Good afternoon. It's Friday, June 4th, 2021, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer, and I'm pleased to be able to bring you the news today. Let's take a look at what we'll be reading. First, we'll read front page stories of local interest. At 8:30, we'll read obituaries, and we will conclude with sports and feature stories as time allows. First, let's take a look at the weather. Today, we will have plenty of sunshine with a high of 94. Winds will be out of the south-southwest, 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tonight will be clear and mild with a low of 66. Tomorrow will be hot, breezy in the afternoon with a high of 93 and a low of 69. Sunday will be partly sunny, winds subsiding, and it will be hot with a high of 92 and a low of 69. Monday will be hot with clouds and sun with a high of 91 and a low of 69. And Tuesday will be hot with a blend of sun and clouds and a high of 91 and a low of 64. The sun rose this morning at 5:50 a.m. and will set tonight at 8:58 p.m. Tomorrow we'll have two more minutes of sunshine. The sun will rise at 5:49 a.m. and set at 8:59 p.m. Next, here's the mini editorial, and this comes to us from Diane Bostick of Sioux City. It's just like the white people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, did not want to talk about the Greenwood Massacre 100 years ago today. Today, the Republican senators do not want to talk about the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And again, this comes to us from Diane Bostick of Sioux City. The first front page story is headlined Food Truck Fair, and it's accompanied by a couple of pictures, one showing Lisa Harper handing shrimp and steak tacos out the window to Richard Fortune at Taqueria El Buen Gusto food truck in Sioux City on Thursday, and the other one is showing Sunita Carper preparing taco meat on the stove inside Taqueria El Buen Gusto food truck in Sioux City on Thursday. Sioux City Food Truck Fridays return for fall season, and this comes to us from Earl Horlick of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. Sioux City Food Truck Friday will be returning for a full summer season with a kickoff from 11 a.m. to 1:30 Friday at Pearl Street Park, located at 7th and Pearl Streets, 7th and Pearl. Now in its sixth season, Sioux City Food Truck Friday has grown into a regional destination, according to volunteer organizer Sam Burrish. The event will start off with eight trucks, including returning favorites, as well as the introduction of new trucks, he said. Additional spots may be added as the season progresses. Sioux City Food Truck Friday, presented by Seaboard Triumph Foods in collaboration with Downtown Partners and the City of Sioux City, will run every Friday between now and August 27th. Last season had a delayed start and featured a grab-and-go format because of COVID concerns, Burrish said. This season, trucks will be parked farther apart to create more space for lines. Guests will be able to stay in the park to enjoy lunch outside or order food to go. Over the last six seasons, he said Siouxland's food truck scene continues to develop at a rapid rate. This past year has shown the scene continues to thrive and evolve, Burrish said. Food, culture, and entrepreneurship are important to our vibrant community. We're excited to continue highlighting downtown Sioux City with this event. Indeed, he noted that the variety of menu items have also expanded and are posted weekly at the Sioux City Food Truck Fridays Facebook page. Food trucks offer everything from burgers to gourmet coffees, Burrish said. There is something for everyone. Taqueria El Buen Gusto has been a Food Truck Fridays regular for the past 3 years. A food truck specializing in authentic Mexican fare like tacos, burritos, and tortas, the food truck was started by Mario Torpetti in 2012 while his son Daniel Torpetti Leon handles business matters. Unlike other food businesses, we did okay last year during COVID, Leon said. People weren't anxious to go back to indoor restaurants during the pandemic, but they felt eating outdoors would be safe. Still, it was a stressful time for Leon. A food truck is the only way my mom and dad make a living, Leon said, adding that Taqueria El Buen Gusto can be found at 300 Hamilton Boulevard daily, as well as other locations at other times. We have to work hard to get ahead, but all signs are pointing to a good season for food trucks like Leon's. Things seem to be getting back to normal, he said. We're looking forward to getting back to food truck Fridays. Union leaders cry foul. This comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of Sioux City. Union leaders are sounding the alarm that Woodbury County officials are falling short on a campaign promise to use local contractors and labor to build the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center. Ernie Colt, a business representative for North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, told the Journal Thursday that 90% to 95% of the project will be completed by contractors from outside of the region. The promise of a local workforce to do the project is not happening as much as we would like, he said. So far, the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Authority Board has awarded three contracts to firms beyond the region, $3.4 million to Missouri-based Goldberg Architects, $1.3 million contract to Des Moines-based Baker Group for the project management, and $14.8 million contract to the Indiana-based Pauley Jail Building Company for prefabricated jail cells. Local contracts have been approved for site work and soil settlement monitoring. Now they're looking at awarding the general contractor award to a firm out of the Lincoln, Omaha area, Colt said. Granted, they will be using some local subcontractors, but not enough. The authority received two bids for the general contract. Hausmann Construction, which has an office in Norfolk, Nebraska, bid $58.39 million, and Sioux City-based W.A. Klinger Construction bid $59.3 million. Hausmann submitted a bid of $1.48 million for alternate items, which include space for the county attorney's office, shelf space, secure fences for judges, and a concrete parking lot. Klinger's bid for the alternates was $1.16 million. The authority is expected to select one of the two firms later this month. In March 2020, voters approved a $50.3 million bond measure that calls for future property tax increases to pay for the new law enforcement center. During the election campaign, proponents cited the creation of local construction jobs as among the benefits for the project. Now, local union leaders are worried that too many of those jobs will be filled by workers from outside the region. Colt blames the state law that says governmental bodies must award construction contracts to the lowest responsible responsive bidder. I think that's what they are basing their decisions on, that low bid number, not taking into consideration that low bid number is less than 1.5% different from the second low bid, which is a local contractor who pays a lot in property taxes every year, as we have all paid our property taxes to get this project going in the first place, he said. Now, to see our property taxes going elsewhere is kind of upsetting. Authority Chair Ron Wick said he understands Colt's concerns and agrees the work should be done by local contractors, but the authority has to follow the state law. At the May 27th LEC authority meeting, board members asked if they could choose to accept Klinger's bid. The authority has been approached by citizens referencing the city choosing local over low bidders. Board of Supervisor Chairman Rocky DeWitt said he asked the county attorney's office what language determines if the authority is required to accept the low bid, but there is not a firm answer at this point. Construction was originally set to begin earlier this year, but was delayed by the rising costs of building materials triggered by a disruption in supply chains due to the COVID-19 pandemic. To cover the shortfall, local leaders have proposed tapping into CARES relief funding from the federal government. The county is slated to receive around $18.8 million from the stimulus bill, which includes payment to state and local governments to help cover costs and budget shortfalls related to the pandemic. Colt questioned whether the county has the authority to do so. During Tuesday's Board of Supervisor meeting, he referenced a paragraph of the U.S. Treasury Department interim final rule on the implementation of the Coronavirus Local Fiscal Recovery Fund. The rule says recipients who spend the dollars on construction projects should use strong labor standards, including project labor agreements and community benefits agreements that offer wages at or above prevailing rates and include local hire provisions. Assistant County Attorney Joshua Widman said the interim rules are geared toward different projects, but there are possibly pieces of the law enforcement center that can comply with the rules. Even though the Baker Group's Shane Albright and County Finance Director Dennis Butler both said they feel confident the county can use the relief funds for the jail. The county this week submitted a letter to Iowa Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst and Iowa 4th District Representative Randy Feenstra outlining why the jail should be eligible for the funds. And journal reporter Dolly Butts contributed to this story. Auditor questions governor's spending. And this comes to us from Des Moines. Iowa's Democratic auditor accused the state's Republican governor Thursday of violating a 2018 state law that prohibits statewide elected officials from using public funds for self-promotion, arguing she broke the law by making ads promoting the coronavirus public safety measures. Auditor Rob Sand said an ad campaign launched by Governor Kim Reynolds in November that was designed to slow the spread of the coronavirus violated the law because it featured Reynolds, who used more than $500,000 of federal coronavirus relief funding for the ads. Sand said his office conducted an investigation of the ad campaigns that was funded with money that was intended to pay for expanded testing capacity for COVID-19 and improved collection and reporting of the data about the pandemic. Sand said Reynolds' office didn't seek federal approval to spend the money on an ad campaign until after it was announced and 5 weeks after his office requested invoices for the spending. He said emails show the state got approval for use of the funds in February. Reynolds, in a statement, denied she violated the law, saying it clearly provides an exception for when a governor proclaims a disaster emergency. Such a proclamation was in effect for the pandemic at the time. Promoting the requirements and recommendations of a disaster proclamation in a public awareness campaign is a clear example of the public emergency exemption in Iowa's image and likeness statute, she said. In the statement, Reynolds Chief of Staff Sarah Craig said, any competent reading of the plain language of state code would have acknowledged the role of the governor in promoting an emergency order. Sand responded by saying Reynolds could have suspended the law in her disaster proclamations, but did not. Nothing contained in this declaration should be construed as an exemption from any other portion of the Iowa Code, her proclamations said. Therefore, the law prohibiting statewide elected officials from self-promotion through the use of public monies applies, said Sand, an attorney and former assistant Iowa Attorney General. It's not the first time Reynolds has been challenged for her use of federal COVID-19 relief money. In October, Sand accused Reynolds of improperly using $21 million in federal virus relief funds for an accounting software system. Federal officials agreed, and Reynolds later returned the money. The legislature appropriated funding for the system out of state taxpayer funds. Sand concluded that about $152,000 out of the $511,789 spent on the advertising campaign was used to purchase time and placement of the video featuring Reynolds on websites and radio and television stations statewide, potentially violating the 2018 law. The law was passed to stop the use of taxpayer dollars for self-promotion of politicians, such as the governor and other state officials promoting themselves at Iowa State Fair booths. In addition, State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald, a Democrat, has appeared in ads promoting the College Savings Iowa program. During legislative debates, Democrats argued whether Secretary of State Paul Pate could no longer distribute flyers about voter registration with his name and photo. The measure was pushed by Ashley Hinson, who was then a Republican state representative and now is a congresswoman. She argued on the House floor, "This applies to anybody, regardless of party." The law says anyone willfully violating it must pay out of their campaign funds an amount equal to that used to fund the communication. A violator may also be subject to a serious misdemeanor criminal charge. Sand said Reynolds would have known her legal duty to avoid self-promotion in the ads because she signed the law. He added the violation appears to be voluntary and intentional because the governor herself publicly announced and described the ad campaign, sat down to film her portions of it, and chose to read multiple lines so that it three times during the video spots, all three identifying characteristics that the law prohibits, like name, likeness, and voice, were present. Sand's report said the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board should review the issue. Sand, who is serving his first term as state auditor, is often mentioned as a potential challenger to Reynolds if she runs again. He has not said whether he will seek re-election or run for another office in November of 2022. River runoff continues at below average pace. This comes to us from Nick Heitrich of the Sioux City Journal from Omaha. Continued dry conditions have put runoff into the Missouri River above Sioux City on pace for one of the drier years on record. Runoff into the river's upper basin was 64% of average in May and followed the ninth driest April in 123 years of record keeping. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on Thursday forecast 2021 runoff at 17.9 million acre feet, 69% of average. That total would be the 22nd driest year in the basin since 1898. The average annual runoff is 25.8 MAF. Per our June 1st upper basin forecast, we expect runoff to be well below average through the summer and fall, John Remus, chief of the Corps' Missouri River Basin Water Management Division, said in a news release. The low amount of water flowing into the river's six reservoirs will lead to a reduction in water releases from Gavin's Point Dam near Yankton, South Dakota, in support of the second half of the navigation season. Winter releases from Gavin's Point likely will be at the minimum level of 12,000 cubic feet per second, Remus said. Precipitation in Montana and the Dakotas has been well below normal since October, and mountain snowpacks that melts and feeds the Missouri River in the late spring and early summer also was below normal levels. As of Tuesday, reservoir storage through the system was 55.2 MAF, 0.9 MAF below the base of the annual flood control zone. The low level shows there is currently no spring precipitation or snowmelt occupying the system's flood control zone. Water releases from Gavin's Point remains at 29,500 CFS. And bike sucks to make return to Sioux City. And this shows a picture of Judy Bonnerts posing with her bike May 28th at her Sioux City home. Bonnerts will be among the cyclists this year on Bike Sucks, and that's S-U-X, which is set for Saturday. The annual ride benefits the Sioux City Journal's Goodfellow Charities. This comes to us from Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal. Bike SUX is returning for 2021 after a hiatus last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The 11th annual Bike SUX, a fundraiser for the Journal's Goodfellow Charities, is set to begin at Caribou Coffee, 2939 Hamilton Boulevard, on Saturday. Registration begins at 8 a.m. and riders take off at 9. The ride was started in 2009 by Cynthia Donovan, the now retired classified and digital director of the Sioux City Journal, and her husband John Donovan. The Donovans have stepped back from the ride this year. Each year, Bike Sucks raises somewhere in the neighborhood of $13,000 to $18,000 for Goodfellows, the more than century-old tradition that gives Christmas presents to needy children. It's the only major fundraiser this time of year for the Christmas season charity. Ashley Stokely, a Bike Sucks board member and journal advertising specialist, said the ride is expected to attract around 100 cyclists this year, or possibly somewhat more. So far, we've had a lot of very good feedback, and a lot of people are really excited to get out on the trails again, and it's just a really fun family event, Stokely said. The ride traditionally ended at Bamboo's, a bar along the Big Sioux River, but the bar is closed. Bamboo's, part of the Missouri River Boat Club's clubhouse, had a difficult year after erosion on the river caused part of the structure to collapse at the beginning of 2020. Fundraising and repairs are ongoing. I think we're planning on having somebody there, like some volunteers with water and stuff like that, and raffle tickets, and then they can turn around and go back, Stokely said, although some of the more seasoned riders proceed on their own to the Adams Homestead and Nature Preserve in North Sioux City. Lunch for the riders is at Jolly's on the River, 1100 Larson Park Road. Judy Bonnerts, a dental hygienist, has taken part in Bike Sucks for the past decade and is looking forward to getting back on the trails this year. Bonnerts, who is also part of the Siouxland Cyclists, a local bicycle group, said her favorite part of Bike Sucks is comparing bicycles with other riders and comparing the number of miles ridden. It's just a way to get together with a lot of people, she said. Last summer with Ragbri, Bike Sucks and other smaller rides called off because of the pandemic, Bonnerts and her bicycling friends did some informal, socially distanced rides on their own. We just kind of made up our own, did our own thing, she said. Bike Sucks will not have a poker run this year, but there are a lot of really nice raffle items this year, Stokely said, including numerous gift baskets, hotel stays, gift certificates, Wells Enterprises ice cream coupons, and more. Cyclists on the roughly 19-mile round-trip trek make a series of optional stops at bars along the route. And we have an editorial on the opinion page from Other Voices. And this one comes to us from Al Giese, the owner of Prairie Feed and Trucking in Milford. Grassley Ernst take lead on climate and ag support. Our state is full of leaders, innovative thinkers, and great implementers that continue to set the standards for how America can successfully and responsibly function. Across Iowa industry and government, from agriculture to small business to manufacturing and clean energy, Iowans develop and implement emission-cutting technologies and share them with the rest of the country. Because of our expertise in being national leaders, it comes as no surprise that Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst have become conservative frontrunners on the bipartisan climate policy that directly benefits Iowa and our agricultural community. Recently, they both signed on to the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which is known by the initials GCSA, introduced with 21 GOP senators and 20 Democratic sponsors. GCSA enables farmers to monetize their participation in verified voluntary carbon credit markets by engaging in conservation-oriented soil practices that sequester atmospheric carbon, like minimum or no-till and cover crop farming. Our farmers can bolster their revenue while playing lead roles in reducing our domestic carbon emissions. Senator Grassley is known for his impactful action on biofuels and wind energy, and his leadership created a booming renewable industry in Iowa, leading to broad economic investment in all sectors, demonstrating positive movement for both clean energy and economic investment. I've personally witnessed the incredible economic effects of his support for renewables in Northwest Iowa. This year, our senators are applying the same creative process, driving common sense climate policy aimed at reducing our emissions to directly benefit one of our most important sectors, Agriculture touches the life of every Iowan, and we all have much to gain from this critical piece of legislation. Each and every Iowan wins with healthier soils and cleaner air. Additionally, when new sustainable income streams are made available to our farming operations, more dollars are injected into our state and local economies. Iowa's biofuels industry will also be able to participate in the new carbon credit cash crop. Many farmers, including my own family farm partnership, are already early adopters of these conservative friendly practices that sequester carbon that will prove the positive impact in our own fields right here in Iowa. Although it will not single-handedly solve all of our emissions problems in this country, it will be a critical first step that opens the doors to bipartisan, common sense climate policy over the coming years. As I have said before, carbon sequestration is a necessary and beneficial objective for the ag community, and as the voluntary carbon credit market continues to develop, it offers even greater potential for Iowa. It clearly has the potential of accessibility and simple and accurate verification, which translates into great growth opportunities on the horizon for Iowa and Iowa's agriculture. I am pleased and proud that I can thank Senators Grassley and Ernst for their support of this legislation, and I and all Iowans can count on their future leadership on bipartisan climate solutions. And again, this comes to us from Al Giese, who is the owner of Prairie Feed and Trucking in Milford. It is nearly half past the hour, and it's time to turn now to the obituaries. The first obituary today comes from Bancroft, Nebraska. Frank J. Pope, 91, died Wednesday, June 2nd. Arrangements pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. From Sioux City Connie Oslin Stiles. Connie Oslin Stiles of Sioux City passed away on Wednesday, June 2nd. Services will be 11 a.m. on Tuesday, with visitation from 9 to 11 at St. Olaf Lutheran Church in Walnut Grove, Minnesota. Burial will be at Tracy City Cemetery in Tracy, Minnesota. Visitation in Sioux City will be from 4 to 8 p.m. today, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Home, Morningside Chapel. Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel is handling the arrangements. Online condolences may be left at www.christysmith.com. Connie Oslin Stiles was born September 22, 1939, at home on the family farm in Jeffers, Minnesota, Cottonwood County, to Carl and Martha Warner Oslin. She was baptized November 12, 1939, at Highwater Lutheran Church in Lamberton, Minnesota, and was confirmed at St. Olaf Lutheran Church July 11, 1954, in Walnut Grove. She graduated from Walnut Grove High School in 1957. Furthering her education, she went to Union Hospital Nursing School in New Ulm, Minnesota, graduating in 1959. She worked in the Westbrook Hospital in Westbrook, Minnesota, until she was united in marriage to Daniel Stiles, March 11, 1960, at St. Olaf Lutheran Church in Walnut Grove. She worked at Tracy Hospital till Dan started his career with NCR in June of 1962. They moved many times over the years, but settled in Sioux City in 1965 and have been there since. Connie worked part-time at St. Luke's Hospital. She enjoyed caring for her patients. Another thing she enjoyed and looked forward to was going to Women of Faith seminars with her daughter and sisters. It was the highlight of the year for 10 years. From Evans, Georgia, formerly of Sioux City, Earl Mack McKinley, Jr. Mr. Earl Mack McKinley, Jr., beloved husband of Allison B. McKinley, entered into rest on Monday, May 31st, at his residence. Services will be held 11 a.m. today at Platt's Bel Air Road Chapel with Reverend Theodore Agba officiating. The family will receive friends 1 hour prior to the service. Online condolences may be made at www.platts.funeralhome.com. Mack was a native of Sioux City who served 8 years in the Army National Guard. He was a softball coach for Westside High School and Augustana Christian School, and was an avid hunter and fisherman. To his friends, he was a trusted confidant, and to his family, he will be remembered as a loving husband, father, brother, and son. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Earl McKinley Memorial Scholarship, P.O. Box 708, Evans, Georgia, 30809. From Sioux City, Lorraine R. Lori Olson, 69, of Sioux City, died Tuesday, June 1st. Services will be June 7th, 1130, pardon me. Services will be June 7th at 1030 a.m., Mater Dei Parish Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. Burial after the services will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be June 6th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue. And from Marcus, Iowa, Lorraine Cave, 88, of Marcus, passed away on Wednesday, June 2nd, at her home, surrounded by her family. Services will take place at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, June 5th, at Peace Lutheran Church in Marcus. Reverend Kevin Roop will officiate. Burial will follow at Marcus Amherst Cemetery in Marcus. Visitation with the family present will be from 4 to 7 p.m. today, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. all at the church. There will also be 1 hour of visitation at the church prior to the funeral on Saturday. The Ernest Johnson Funeral Home in Marcus is assisting the family. Expressions of sympathy may be directed to the family at www.maurerjohnsonfh.com. Lorraine Frieda Bay Cave, the daughter of Henry and Dorothy Peters Bay, was born August 26, 1932, in Correctionville. She grew up on a farm in rural Correctionville and attended country school until seventh grade. At that time, she moved with her family to her mother's family farm near Germantown. She graduated from Paulina High School in 1950. On September 2, 1951, she was married to her lifelong companion of 67-plus years, Jim Cave of Marcus. Together, they lived, farmed, and raised eight children on the Cave family farm until Jim's passing in 2019. Lorraine continued to reside on the farm until her passing. She was very active in her community and church. She volunteered as Girl Scout leader for over 30 years in the fancy work department at Marcus Fair, in the Marcus Elementary School, at Cherokee Hospice, and at Heartland Care Center Auxiliary. At Peace Lutheran Church, she taught Sunday school for 25 years, taught midweek classes, was a member of the Ladies' Aid, and was involved with the Braille Workshop for over 35 years. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family and will be donated to a local charity at a later date. Roger E. German of Seymour, Indiana, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, May 31st. Services will be conducted at 1 p.m. on Monday at St. Ambrose Catholic Church in Seymour. A private family interment will be at St. Joseph Cemetery in Anthem. Arrangements are with Spurgeon Funeral Home in Brownstown, Indiana. Online condolences may be made at www.spurgeonfh.com. Born on May 19, 1942 in Sioux City, Roger was the son of Jake and Orpha Larson German. On August 26, 1967, in Eugene, Oregon, he married Connie Carter. From Dakota City, Catherine Christie Hinges, 72, died Tuesday, June 1st. No services are planned. Arrangements are with Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. From Ottawa, Iowa, Erica Jo Carrier, 42, died Saturday, May 29th. Celebration of life will be June 4th, 7 p.m. at Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa. And from Lamars, Iowa, Fred D. Wells, dairy industry pioneer and former Wells president and chief operating officer, Fred D. Wells passed away peacefully on June 12th, surrounded by his family. Fred was the son of Harry C. Wells and nephew of Fred H. Wells, original founders of Wells Dairy, in 1913. A celebration of life honoring Fred will be held starting at 6 p.m. on Friday, June 11th at the Marriott Riverfront, 385 East 4th Street in South Sioux City. Fred D. Wells was born April 29, 1927 to Harry C. and Frieda Levson Wells in Dolan, South Dakota. He began working at Wells as a young man after school, loading trucks and working as a relief driver. He graduated from Sioux City East High in 1945. Fred enlisted in the United States Navy and served in the Pacific Theater, first on a Navy destroyer and then on a troop carrier during World War II. After returning from service, Fred attended Morningside College in Sioux City and began his long career with the family business in 1946. Fred married Barbara Mulford of Kingsley on April 1, 1951. They celebrated 53 years together. From Sioux City, Carlton Thomas Grinberg. Carlton Thomas Grinberg, 91, a lifelong Sioux City resident, died on Thursday, May 27. Carlton's funeral will take place at 1 p.m. on Saturday at Morningside Lutheran Church, 700 South Martha Street. Pastor David Grinberg and Pastor Tom Lovan will officiate. A Graceland Park Cemetery interment will follow the worship service. Morningside Lutheran will host the visitation, which will take place 1 hour before the funeral from 12 to 1 p.m., and online condolences may be made at www.christysmith.com. Carlton was born March 2, 1930, in Sioux City to Arnold and Ellen Wenberg Grinberg. He grew up in Sioux City and was a 1948 East High School graduate. During the Korean War, Carlton enlisted in the United States Air Force. He was stationed on Hokkaido Island, Japan, where he served as a radio operator. After his honorable discharge, he secured a job with Iowa Public Service, where he eventually managed the company's shareholder records. On February 16, 1957, in Council Bluffs, Carlton married Della Blades. Carlton was an active member of Morningside Lutheran Church and VASA, a Swedish-American cultural organization. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Morningside Lutheran Church. We have several briefs today that we will read from the local page. From Sheldon, Iowa, police searching for robbery suspect. Authorities are searching for a suspect in connection with the robbery of a Sheldon bank Thursday morning. The Sheldon Police Department said in a Facebook post that they are looking for a black male who is approximately 6 feet 2 inches tall. The suspect was wearing a mask, red glasses, white gloves, and a blackish-gray pants when he robbed the Iowa State Bank, according to the post. Anyone with information is asked to call the Sheldon Police Department at 712-324-2525 or the O'Brien County Sheriff's Office at 712-957-3415. Sand coming to Sioux City for town hall. From Sioux City, State Auditor Rob Sand is planning a town hall in Sioux City on Friday. The town hall is slated to begin at 2 p.m. Friday at Mid-City Park, 801 Court Street. Sand will discuss his work in the auditor's office, and there will be a question and answer session. Attendees are welcome to bring a lawn chair. Sand, a Democrat with a very active presence on social media, was elected in 2018. He has not decided whether to run for re-election or seek the Democratic nomination for governor in 2022. Sand will return to Northwest Iowa next week for an open house at Perry Creek Dairy, northwest of Merrill. At that event, which starts at 3:15 p.m. on June 9th, Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg will issue a dairy proclamation signed by Governor Kim Reynolds. From Sioux City, portion of Ingleside Avenue to close. A segment of Ingleside Avenue is slated to close next week due to a reconstruction project on the road. Ingleside Avenue will be closed from 18th to 21st Streets beginning the morning of June 7th. Work on the road should be complete by the end of November, according to a press release from the city. An ongoing adjacent road closure on 19th Street from Ingleside Avenue to Virginia Street will remain for the time being. A contractor will replace the roadway, sidewalks, and city utilities, including storm, water, sewer, and water lines. From Sioux City man charged with sexual abuse. A Sioux City man was arrested Wednesday on suspicion of sexually abusing a young girl. Ernesto Carnales, 42, is being held in the Woodbury County Jail on a $25,000 bond. He faces one count of second degree sexual abuse. According to court documents, Sioux City police received a sexual abuse report involving Canales on May 14th. The victim, who is under 10, had told interviewers at a child advocacy center in Lincoln, Nebraska, that Canales had touched her anus and vagina, and the touching occurred sometime between December 1st and May 1st. From Moorhead, Iowa, motorcyclist killed in Monona County crash. A Nebraska man died Wednesday after his motorcycle struck a semi-trailer while both were attempting to pass another motorist. According to the Iowa State Patrol, Stephen Hendricks, 68, of Columbus, was northbound on his motorcycle on Highway 183 north of the Monona-Harrison County line at about 2:03 p.m. when he began to pass another motorist. Hendricks apparently did not notice that a semi-trailer driven by Eric Henschen, 25, of Ute, that had been behind him had entered the southbound lane to pass him. Hendricks struck the passenger side of the truck and suffered fatal injuries. From Sioux City, man pleads not guilty to pouring gas on couple. An Omaha man has pleaded not guilty to breaking into a Sioux City home, finding the couple who lived there, and pouring gas on them before ransacking the home. Richard Pollock, 41, entered his written pleas Wednesday in Woodbury County District Court to charges of first-degree burglary, first-degree arson, assault, and, while participating in a felony, second-degree theft, credit card fraud, and aggravated assault. According to court documents, Pollock, an accomplice, both wearing ski masks, entered the home in the 1600 block of George Street on December 16th and struck the male resident in the head with a pipe, causing a large laceration. The two bound the man and the woman with zip ties and poured gas on them, then ransacked the house, stealing the man's wallet. Pollock made more than $1,500 in withdrawals using the victim's debit card, court documents said. The other person involved in the incident has not been arrested. And from Sioux City, man charged with breaking ex-girlfriend's nose. From Sioux City, an Onawa, Iowa man has been charged with breaking into an ex-girlfriend's Sioux City home in the middle of the night and breaking her nose in seven places. Cody Conyers, age 27, was arrested Wednesday and booked into Woodbury County Jail on charges of first-degree burglary and willful injury. He is being held on a $25,000 bond. According to court documents, the woman told the police she had ended her relationship with Conyers on February 22nd. After midnight on February 23rd, Conyers entered her home, and after the woman told him to leave, Conyers said she was going to get what she deserved. Conyers is accused of squeezing the woman's neck and repeatedly punching her in the face. The woman suffered bruising to her face, neck, and back, two cuts to her left eye, and another on her face that left permanent scars. Surgery was required to repair her broken nose. The woman told police Conyers was under the influence of alcohol and methamphetamine. After he left, she exited her home and flagged down a passing motorist to call 911 because Conyers had destroyed her phone, court documents said. Online court records show Conyers had been jailed in Monona County, where he pleaded guilty in May to a 2018 assault and theft. Prosecution of those crimes had been delayed while Conyers served a South Dakota prison sentence for thefts committed in Union County. We have time now for a story from the sports page. Morningside names new coaches. From Sioux City, Morningside announced on Thursday that Alex Struck and Addison Mertler as the new head coaches in men's and women's tennis and men's volleyball. Struck will lead the men's and women's tennis programs. He is no stranger to the Mustang family, as he was four-year team member and captain as an undergraduate, part of a playing resume in which he also held the single-season victory record at one point. Struck earned all Great Plains Athletic Conference honors in 2015 in singles and in 2013 in doubles, along with gaining two Daktronics National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics Scholar Athlete Awards and a Collegiate Sports Information Director of America College Division Academic At-Large Selection. Things have come full circle, Strzok said. I was able to have a wonderful collegiate student-athlete experience, and now I'm getting to coach at Morningside too. I often wondered what it would be like, and even hoped that I'd have the opportunity to come back. It's a great situation, working with so many people I knew from my undergraduate time and building two programs. Before returning to Morningside, Strzok was head coach at Lamar's High School. The Bulldogs experienced impressive successes under his tutelage. They went 12-2, advanced to the Iowa High School Athletic Association Class 1A state quarterfinals, and picked up a pair of third-place team marks at the Missouri River Conference and district tournaments. Mertler will guide the men's volleyball program. He was previously on the coaching staff of fellow GPAC school Dort University, serving as an assistant coach for both the men's and women's programs. While part of the Defenders' fledgling men's and highly successful women's programs, he obtained a master's degree in the field of athletic leadership. The Boca Raton, Florida native's collegiate playing career was in the Navy and Gold of Lakeland University in Plymouth, Wisconsin, where he made his mark in the Muskies' record books as setter, scoring the career assists mark at 2,554, with all four of his seasons ranking among the top 10 in school history. He also registered in the top 5 in career digs and aces. This concludes the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 4th, 2021. If you have any questions or comments for Iris, please call us toll-free at 1-877-404-4747. Thank you for listening to your Sioux City Journal.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. On other EarthDates, we talked about how humans have used, and sometimes overused, water from aquifers to grow crops or build cities where previously none could exist. It might surprise you to know there are also many places where we're putting water back. This aquifer management takes many forms. Perhaps the simplest is called conjunctive use. That means providing surface water, during wet times, to users who would normally pump groundwater. Another method is called managed aquifer recharge. It routes surface water into man-made or natural infiltration basins, where it can gradually seep into the aquifer. Perhaps the best example of this channels floodwater away from population areas and into recharge ponds. Surface infiltration has the added benefit of purifying the water as it percolates through layers of soil and rock. In the most elaborate method, called aquifer storage and recovery, water is pumped directly into aquifers to stabilize or reverse groundwater depletion. It has been used in coastal areas to stop salt water from gradually entering aquifers and replacing fresh water. Long-term studies show these practices are working. In California, water tables would have dropped hundreds of feet deeper without aquifer management. In parts of Arizona, they're actually rising. This doesn't mean we can get cavalier about freshwater use, but it does show how human ingenuity can address critical environmental problems. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.